Wednesday, December 13th. I was up at 7 o'clock before it's really quite day, and dressed in my ranch pants and boots and downstairs in the kitchen having coffee before 7:30. Mr. Swanson and Mr. Myrick joined me, and we drove around over the Martin Ranch in search of live oak trees. We'd struck out on some of the best ones we had selected. When they tried to dig them, they found they were growing in soil about 18 inches deep, and then it deteriorated into shale and caliche. This could not be successfully balled. So we went to the little valley on the northwest side of the Martin and surveyed several groups of trees, walking round and round, looking at the height and the structure of the limbs, and trying to visualize its relation to the house and to the total grounds. I like doing this. It will be more my tree because of it. I was back at the ranch by 8:30. We picked up the Melvin Warrens and their camera and drove over to the West Ranch. They had wanted to see some stone fences. Nowhere in this countryside are there better stone fences than on the West Ranch, where they wander over the hills and down into the valleys for endless miles, and you marvel at the man-hours, the lifetimes of labor it took to build them, somewhere back between the 1850s and the 1880s, when barbed wire came to this country. We stopped several times to take pictures, and for them to make a sort of a mental note of where they were, because they would certainly come back later for sketching or painting when the sun was out. Alas, our beautiful golden days were gone. There was mist, there was almost rain. Then we came to one of my favorite spots, the stone corral. I'll always wonder why they built it there. It's almost 5 feet high, still very solid. It would still hold cattle, if not goats. But the floor or ground is almost solid rock. It was built on an outcropping along the ledge of a creek where tall cypress grow, bare now, some of the most majestic and intriguing trees I know. A leftover, scientists tell me, from the days of the dinosaur. There were the outlines of an old settler's cabin close by, a smoke-stained chimney, a big round meat block made from a cut through some huge cypress tree. You just wonder what the history of this place is. But I think there's a basis there for a good painting, and the Warrens were delighted. I told them what it was like in April, with a sea of bluebonnets in the pasture, hundreds of mountain laurel, or the great stone escarpment along a creek where I once walked and met a rattlesnake. We toured the whole ranch, and then we came home by the Scharnhorst and went through the river pasture, seeing long sweeps of the Rocky Perdinalis and many deer. On the way back, we talked about them doing pictures for the president during the next year or two, and perhaps coming out to stay at the Lewis or the Cedar House for a week at a time whenever they wanted to, especially in the spring, and made a sort of a loose agreement that they would. And then at 11 o'clock, with the feeling it had already been quite a day, I was back at the main house, changed to city clothes, got into the little plane with some misgivings, was off on a very bouncy trip to San Antonio, praising the Lord when I touched ground. Drove in to the Whitty Museum, where Nancy Negley and Mrs. Charles Urschel met me. I had wanted to see the diorama there of the Edwards Plateau. A couple of years before, someone from the Whitty had written me that they would like to go to the Scharnhorst and collect rocks and make pictures, the grasses and flowers and animals and scenery, for a diorama. This was the result. I had a tour of the museum with a very delightful curator and saw about half a dozen dioramas, beginning with a wonderfully dramatic one of the plains country, with a herd of buffalo, one enormous, standing in deep grass, and a great one of the Big Bend country, the panther that Liz promised us but never showed, crouched over his kill, a deer, on one of the crags of the Chisos Mountains. It turned out that our diorama was really just the Scharnhorst itself. The background, our big granite rock extrusion, painted by Porphyria Salinas. And in the foreground, a knee-deep sea of coreopsis and bluebonnets. It was really quite pretty, and I was proud. The curator described the Whitty as a regional museum. It's extraordinarily diverse. Indian artifacts, a gallery of modern-day rooms done by designers, collections of jades and porcelains and furniture from all over the world, and paintings. What it lacked and what made me sad was that it wasn't full, it wasn't bustling. Out of love to see it just teeming with life, school children, tourists, San Antonians who came to see the latest exhibit. And yet, so much of it was worth seeing. I wondered how to bridge the gap. Next, we went to Janet Shook's gallery and looked at her wonderful needlework. And upstairs, where she has quite a collection of paintings. There was a delightful one in the manner of a French impressionist, the girl in the yellow hat, and some Bill Hoey landscapes, the blue sky across which white clouds are scudding, and you can almost feel the April breeze, and some funny watercolors by Bill Hogan, adobe shacks with Mexicans lounging in front, Pepsi Cola and Dairy Cream signs and filling stations, but somehow managed to be whimsical and sad and yet linger in your memory. And bright Bristol landscapes and little miniatures by a retired general. A delicious lunch was spread out, sandwiches and cookies and drinks. And we ate and talked and had a wonderful offbeat time. We went on to the McNay Art Institute. And there I saw whole walls of paintings that were for rent or purchase. Some Art Nouveau posters that I wondered about getting for Lindbergh. And a head that looks so much like a Renoir, although by an almost unknown artist. If I were both bolder and richer, I could have had a wonderful time. This, too, alas, was too quiet a place to suit me. I would like to have found it bustling. There were many good things. An El Greco in the entrance, a Diego Rivera, a whole room of small Renoirs. We drove on by Bill Bristow's house, but he was not at home, and then hurried to the airport. Bad weather was overtaking us. I hugged Nancy goodbye and flew home through a front. It was no fun at all.
Back at the house
before 4:30, I surveyed with much satisfaction the live oak that we had selected for the northwest corner of my garden. It was perfect. Rarely do you get such a thrill. Our work had turned out well, the way the branches spread, its relation to the house, the way it looks from my bay window. Just a joy. I shall count this one of Mary's gifts for my Christmas. Through Nash, she had gotten in touch with Mr. Myrick and arranged to buy some of the trees. The red oak was also in the ground. I am not wholly in favor of it, but Mr. Myrick assures me I must have height and a graceful tree in that place and will spread later. Mr. Myrick was going to have to leave to catch a 7 o'clock plane in Austin, so we had one last drive around the place to assess the proper planting of any screening in front of the incinerator and the placement of trees in front of Mr. Klein's workshop. We looked at the whole place through Lawrence Rockefeller's binoculars from the ranch road. It's all shaping up very well. I said goodbye to Mr. Myrick by 5:30 and found the Melvin Warrens sitting in the living room, patiently waiting to make their goodbyes. And lo and behold, they had spent the afternoon in the almost misting rain making a sketch of the old stone fort in Johnson City. Two sketches, in fact. One of them, I was charmed by it. It's the one with the arched doorway. So I could think I had really done a good day's work. They're interesting people. I'd love to hear them talking about the research they had done on making the drawings for the old forts of Texas, a string of some 6 or 8 old forts that had protected the settlers and the travelers of Texas from the Indians from the 1840s to the 1890s. And now they are doing a series of paintings on the old trails of Texas, the Chisholm Trail, the Goodnight Trail. By 6:30, they were gone. I had a shampoo and a set with Mrs. Frederick Berg, reading under the dryer, and then dinner downstairs with just Dorothy Torito, telling me about her day's adventures in Austin with Mrs. Hudspeth, hearing all the preparations that the university is making for the Lyndon Johnson Library, the bibliography, its acquisitions, going over the site, and then to bed early. One of the luxuries of this little interim, but making phone calls and planning for the morrow and reading myself to sleep.